I really hate Phantom of the Opera.
I find it delightful.
Then I question your taste in musical theater.
Hello and welcome to The Dirt. I am Tim Wright and today I'm here with Steve Hickey.
Morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve. I'm also here with Mark Grambo.
Hey, Tim.
Hello, Mark. It's great to be sitting with you once again. And today we are very excited to welcome Paula Scher, partner at Pentagram, onto the show. Paula, welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to see you guys.
Good to see you, too. So this is part of a series we're doing on successful product design, and we wanted to talk to Paula about branding today.
That's right. And the designers in our audience may really already well know Paula and Pentagram as leaders in our industry. But for our listeners who are maybe newer to design or who are developers, Paula, could you tell us a bit about Pentagram?
Yes, I think that Pentagram is best described as an interdisciplinary firm where partners run their own teams, and we call it design-led strategy as opposed to strategy-led design. Mm. In other words, the designers work directly with the clients, hopefully with decision makers, to develop systems and languages that best express products and services and that sort of thing. And it may manifest itself as a classic identity that has logo components and typographic systems, or it may manifest itself as product design. It may manifest itself as a sign system or environmental graphics. It's really whatever is needed. But the thinking is the same. It's the product, institution, corporation that drives the thinking in a very specific relationship to make something specific for a basic company and audience.
Great, that's great. And in our day-to-day job, we frequently deal with products more than anything else. We're an experience design and product firm. So I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of an intro to how you begin branding a product. I know you've worked on a few big high-profile ones over the last couple of years.
Well, I think that there are two things that really, actually probably three things that are a work. There's the product itself. Like, what is the product doing? What is the spirit of the product? Is the product revolutionary? Is the product conservative? How do you understand the product? What does it do, and how does one engage with it? So that's number one. Number two is, what is the general milieu in which the product is fitting in? Who are the competitors? What is the audience like? What is the expectation of what can be accepted in the marketplace against that product? And then how can we elevate that? And then the third thing is really, what is the political makeup of the organization, and how are they going to be able to make decisions properly and execute? And they're all equally important. If you only get two of them right, you fail. You have to get all three of them right.
Okay, so how would you say that applied to Microsoft and the rebranding of Windows 8? I mean, that seems like a huge, intimidating project.
It was a both intimidating and huge and incredibly intimate. The Windows 8 people, first of all, I should back up and say that this was an unusual situation because Microsoft was not Pentagram's client. Wolf Olins works directly with Microsoft. And what had happened was that there was the product launch of Windows 8, the elephant in the room at Microsoft, because it's so big in relationship to so many of the other companies, and that Microsoft was looking for a way to connect its visual identity system across the board. And they had, and Wolf Olin had actually been working in that capacity, but they were working centrally. And I think that in the process of that work, Windows 8, which was a pretty revolutionary product for Windows and for Microsoft at that time, felt like they wanted more direct attention in relationship to the identity before the other things happened. So they actually sort of decided, okay, let's, they wanted to hire a design firm where they were going to have some kind of interactivity. And there was somebody who drove the process, this wonderful man named Sam Moreau, who was a true believer in Windows 8 and what that could do and how that could change Microsoft and what that meant for products in the future and what that meant for the way you might begin to understand the company. Mm-hmm. So that within that process, my dialogue with him was quite intimate because we were really trying to figure out what this language could be. We knew it could be simple. And in doing it, we had to analyze why there was so much complexity in what already existed at Microsoft. So that when we just in looking at the Windows logo, you knew that whoever had authored the logo that was wavy, you know, the flag or whatever you want to call it, that actually I could see that coming out of some business meeting where somebody designed a logo in perspective, and then everybody said, oh, it's too flat, it doesn't have enough motion, it doesn't have any dimension, and then you can also see exactly how something like the pre-existing Windows logo would come totally out of that kind of a conversation, of which I've been in many in my career. And, you know, there's dimension to it. And actually, if you looked at the panes of the windows, they didn't look like windows, they looked like pieces of tile because somebody wanted it to have depth. The irony is that, and in fairness to that design, that it happened at a time when that logo was developed where things weren't moving that much on the computer. You were moving things around, but there wasn't really animations, or you didn't see something in perspective without rendering it. And the fact of the matter is the Windows logo as a flat logo, you know, all that the current logo is a grab of essentially a rectangle with four squares in it that's shown at a perspective. Hmm. But the perspective is just a freeze frame in time of this thing that could be perpetually moving. And that the notion of the perspective drawing, and they are actually classic perspective drawing, not the way the computer distorts perspective, that you could use that as a visual language for all of Windows, for all of Microsoft, for all of the products. That if you actually drew every shape that you wanted to off of a classic perspective chart and kept it flat, it could define the entire company, which is exactly what they did with the center of the perspective chart being Microsoft. Because if you go to the center of a perspective chart, you have a complete square broken into quadrants. So that's where it all comes from. So after we did the Windows logo, so essentially we gave a little bit of rules and guidelines about the logo, gave them a perspective chart and left. And everything that followed was either led by Wolf Olins or executed within departments. And I have to say, it's amazing because they actually really held to it. It's just a one-page manual, if you think about it that way.
Yeah, I think it did a wonderful job of setting a language for them, as you said, that Microsoft's previous identity, really, it was just this poster child for the design equivalent of that organization, of something that had grown to be huge and have all these multiple divisions and
cubicles.
And it really, I think, suffered under its own weight, and to give a new fresh start with this language that, you know, refers to the old but gives them an opportunity to find themselves moving forward was great.
And it was more than, I mean, Paula, what you gave them was clearly more than a logo. It was a brand identity. Can you talk about communicating that with a client, that they're not just getting a logo, they're getting an entire identity?
They knew they wanted that. It was that the thing. They were already trying to resolve that with Wolf Olins. The issue was really finding a language that enabled each organization to be individualistic. I mean, if you compare Microsoft to Apple in terms of structure, Apple's very monolithic, and everything has the same name, whether it's iPhone, iPad, everything's black and white, and you have one logo and you don't brand anything. Bill Gates had a very different philosophy about his business structure, and they're very different companies temperamentally. And in Microsoft, the engineers had total power. They set up these companies, they were profit centers, they got to brand their own individual company, they got to brand the products within the company. What amazed me is not only how many logos there were for each individual company, they're all the subsets of logos and the features inside the software. Yep. You know, where you're, and all of a sudden you're looking at one product and you've got all these other things going on there and you go, what's that? You know, and they're very carefully designed dingbats that address that. So it was really the idea of enabling them to be who they were, because it would be unfair to say you can't make an individual mark for a business. I mean, that would be, that would sort of go against their own culture of how they have this really kind of, in a funny way, a fairly loose affiliation between the product line and deservedly so, because in that model, it's actually very similar to a pentagram model. You have these independent units that are profit centers that get to operate with their own personality to a degree, so that the ability was to let them within a structure design any shape they wanted. Mm-hmm. It would just be in perspective, that's all. Mm-hmm. Can't have, you know, drop shadows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So Microsoft had this long history in that you were designing the next iteration of and the next expression of. Can you speak now to the challenges of instead building the identity and the brand and the visual language for something completely new, a brand new company, a brand new identity?
Well, I did that actually by accident. I did it for Shake Shack. It's now a $2 billion company. It was brand new when I did it. It was a hot dog stand across the street. and the job was, I would call it quasi-accidental. There were things that drove what it looked like. There was a shed that was designed by James Wines, and it was dropped into Madison Square Park. And I am the designer for Madison Square Park because it's across the street from Pentagram. Hmm. And the head of the conservancy at Madison Square Park asked me to, you know, design something for this shack that was going to be in the park because they were afraid it was going to be too commercial. And we designed typography. It happened to be Neutra. Because it sat really beautifully on the top of this piece of architecture, and it became the logo of the place. And they had one, and we just put some logos on bags and things. And then they got another place uptown on Columbus Avenue. So we had to actually kind of make a guideline for it. And then they needed other components because they really needed menu boards that were movable. And there was I don't know how familiar you are with Shake Shack in Canada. It's global.
Yeah, we've now got a couple up here in Boston. They've made it up here.
Oh, you're in Boston, not
Canada.
Yeah. Well, you know, right now, honestly, it feels like Canada. So
it's like the third time someone's thought we're from Canada.
That's okay.
It's your thick accent, Tim.
Yeah, that's okay. It's my nice attitude, also.
Yeah.
Well, this thing spread, and we gave them a little baby manual, maybe, I don't know, 8 years ago. And I thought that they were just cheap, and so they held to it so faithfully because they didn't want to have to pay for any new design. But maybe that's as good a way to become a global brand as anything else. And here's what I think was great about the Shake Shack branding, because I will say it's accidental. I mean, there were components of it. When they came back for the second iteration, they asked me for icons or something that would represent more of a 50s roadside stand. And I didn't do it in 50s style. I did it in sort of a more techie, more contemporary style combined with the Neutra. And they were happy with it. But I think that this sort of contemporary take on these kinds of hamburger stands, coupled with what was really the revolutionary part of Shake Shack at its time, which was great food, like a really good hamburger, really good product meat, very good cooking, very healthy and upscale. And it costs $2 more, but you get a very good value for the dollar. And it's not that different from what Chipotle's done. And it's really it's revolutionizing fast food. So that the timing of it was amazing. I can't say that there was any testing or that we did any demographic surveys or that I had a history of a company to look at. There was nothing. There was just the accident and I think the ability to faithfully execute once the accident happened of good design that was a little better than the expectation against very good food. And suddenly that becomes the thing that's imitated because both the look of it against the product raises your expectation of what that's supposed to be. And there'll be a lot more of them. There already are a lot of imitators until you have to go to the next level of how you reinvent what fast food looks like. And that was sort of fun because it was accidental.
Do you personally prefer one over the other, dealing with a large pre-existing product or a new one?
I don't have any judgments about scale or. I mean, I have value judgments about people's business. There's certain businesses I don't like to work because I find them either immoral or I don't relate to them or what have you. But scale is not as important to me as relationship. I mean, can you, and I think this is very much in the Pentagram model, because while we're the largest independently owned design firm, and we have office the same size as New York and London. We have a smaller office in Berlin, Austin, Texas, and San Francisco's quite tiny. We're essentially a bunch of designers who are strung together in common interest. We all own the business, we share profit, and we support each other. But the goal is to design, and the goal is to have access to people who are involved in the process of making design decisions and seeing that these things happen. And I like to be involved from the beginning to the end, if I can be. I want to make sure that there's a plan for execution, because I think if I do a lot of work up front and nobody's executing it properly, it's just a waste of my time, because it's not going to look like anything that we did. So the goal is what happens all the way. If you made it in the room and it's gorgeous and it comes out and it's completely compromised, it never happened. You know, so that's what the level of practice is. It's that kind of personal commitment to make design better.
Yeah, that's a frustration that anyone in a consultancy can certainly relate to. This feeling that you've built this wonderful, great solution, this beautiful design system, and if it gets handed off and gets mutated and perverted, essentially, that it's, you know, what was that time for? You know, what did you just do? It can be very frustrating.
What was great with Windows, for example, is because Wolf Olin was there, and this guy, Todd Simmons, who ran the account, they did a fantastic job. They improved the work. I mean, I love that, and we became friends over it, which was really amazing. That's, you know, great. Like, theoretically, they should have resented me and did not, and it was great. The biggest issue, and what I've been successful with sometimes, is what I like to do is either get the people that are working in-house at a corporation I'm working with to come to Pentagram and work on developing the identity with us, or build an in-house department. I know what's going to happen to it after it leaves. And then I'll sometimes retain like a small consultancy, and sometimes I even do it for no money. I mean, we redid the Philadelphia Museum last year, and it's a mammoth museum. It's about the size of the Metropolitan Museum. It's got an incredible collection. And they really didn't have the ability to execute. I hired somebody I had hired at the Metropolitan Opera and the New York City Ballet to execute the system, and he's in there now, and he's built a fantastic art department. And that's wonderful when it happens, because you actually see the thing you started grow. It gets better. It's better than what you did. You know, and that's what you want to have happen. That's really, so that's the other part of the job. And that I think it's very cynical to think that you're going to design some terrific thing, dump it in a company and walk away from it, because that isn't the job.
We try and build as best we can. You know, the ideal world, any of these design projects are followed up with a long-term partnership in some way, or, as you said, you know, knowing and building the team and the expertise within their companies, so that, you know, there is a smooth and clean handoff to a team that'll take it and improve it. And as a growing company, you know, we win some and lose some in that battle, and it's always really satisfying as these partnerships get stronger over time.
You know, I started an in-house art department, so I have a lot of loyalty to them.
Yeah.
Because I began my career in the record industry at CBS, and I know what it is to work in-house, and generally these people can be very beleaguered because they're in a corporate power structure and they're essentially peons, so they're told what to do when they actually know so much more than they're being allowed to demonstrate, and it's really sad. On top of which, I think that design consultancies as a whole have done sort of a nasty thing to those situations by charging so much for front-end strategy and testing and development, and all the budget is spent up there and there's no money left for execution. That's disgusting. And it's wrong. It doesn't make the product better, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, we deal with a lot of startups in our work, and you often hear the phrase move fast and break things. And I think that that has created a situation where a lot of companies don't take the time to develop a serious brand up front, that they really just, they're focused on building technical solutions. But I think we've also recently seen some really strong change. Like Airbnb went through a very high profile redesign late last year.
Right.
I think that was probably the first exposure a lot of people in the startup world had to the complete reconsidering of a visual identity. And I was just wondering if you had anything you could say about some of the work you've seen done lately, whether it be Airbnb or any other tech company that's done something particularly strong.
I think that there like what happened with Microsoft, there was a split in the industry where the UX community grew so fast that they grew away from the idea of what visual communication is. Mm-hmm. And that I think that it's simply catching up. Mm-hmm. This happened once before in sort of the early days of desktop publishing, where people started making things that were really designed badly because they were working, they were concerned with the technology and not with the other aspect of it. And the technology was driving the situation, so that later they began to catch back up. And then if you think about CD-ROM packaging, when that first started, it was really terrible. Mm-hmm. And then they caught back up. And this has happened classically, so I'm sort of used to it, where when the group of people that are sort of, you know, coming from an engineering standpoint are not necessarily interested in how things look and function. And of course, remember that programming essentially for the past 25 years was done by engineers, not by people who were design trained. Now that boundary is really blurred in the past 5 years. Mm. I mean, my partner Eddie O'Para is a designer and programmer, and the result is spectacular. And that I'm actually starting to design with the understanding that of how I'm going to write the program for the thing. I'm not going to personally write it, but how I'm going to work with somebody to actually create that program. I never thought like that before. So we all come together at some point, and then the next iteration of technology will take off, and that will have the same result as well.
Yeah, it seems like either side of the industry, they sort of move out of sync for a while, and then things change, and they come back into sync, and then something else changes, and they start to move out again. But eventually, everything comes back together.
Well, I think there's something to be said about, and I know it's the thing I harp on a lot, but the anytime a new tool or technology is democratized, and the keys of the kingdom are given to a broader audience, all of a sudden, people who couldn't do a thing before are doing it in big droves. That, you know, whether it's mobile app design or it's web development or it was the introduction
or music.
Or music development, you know, all of a sudden you don't need to go out to a studio, you do it in your home.
Right.
Or this, podcasting. It's no longer the big radio stations and such producing this kind of stuff. There's a big go that just purely says, I want to make a thing and no care to maybe how it's done, but I can do it, my goodness, for the first time. Mm-hmm. And you end up with an explosion of quantity, but at least for a time, a distillation of quality. And naturally, it comes back up again, and you mm-hmm. learn to value the quality.
If you go to desktop publishing, which I think is a great analogy for this, because you have to remember it. I mean, you're talking about something that was happening in from, like, say, late 80s through the early 90s, where people got their first computers and they were really putting the stuff out, and the typography was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, there was no kerning, you couldn't put something on its side, there were like five faces available, just absolutely terrible. And designers, I remember Massimo and Milton were railing against this sort of thing and how terrible the computer was for design, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, lo and behold, typography has never been better than it is now, and that you know, the web world is about to massively explode and be the most design literate, beautiful place because of the introduction of a broader variety of fonts and the ability to use them. And what's happened is typography as an art form is known by everybody. Like, if I'm talking to mainstream media, they're almost more interested in what typeface I used and how it was designed and utilized than the subject of the job. I mean, I find that extraordinary. No one ever said the word font in a sentence 20 years ago. So I can't tell you what happens when the general public becomes involved in some way, and then, of course, it becomes more and more sophisticated as the professionals get back in.
Yeah, I see the massive public mainstream backlash to Comic Sans as this wonderful thing. It just me. If everyone in the world who never designs is aware of the idea enough to be angry about Comic Sans, it's a wonderful thing for our industry because it means people know and they notice and they care. It's beautiful and it's brilliant.
No, it's an incredible change. And it has to do with the fact that there was this incubation period where people messed around on the computers trying to develop their own designs. I mean, DIY, while I both hate it, I have to love it because it makes everybody literate.
Yeah.
Well, Paula, we want to thank you for taking time out of your day to come chat with us. It was great to sit down with you and have this conversation.
Great. Thanks, guys.
And I think on a personal level, we want to thank you for being a pillar of the design community and affecting our careers individually with the work you do.
Yeah, I got in so much trouble at my first job because I read your book, Make It Bigger, and took every part of it to heart. And I wouldn't trade that back. It was worth every second of trouble I got into. So thank you for that.
That's sweet. Thank you.
So if people want to get a hold of you, would the Pentagram Twitter account be the best way to try and harass you?
I'm not difficult to get a hold of, and you can write to info@pentagram.com, and there's a guy there who, you know, sort of helps me not get bombarded, but I'm pretty open about that stuff.
Okay, you can get us on Twitter @TheDirtShow, and please send your long-winded comments to thedirt@freshtilledsoil.com. Please review us on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you're listening to us now on, unless you're driving. We want to again thank Paula Scher for taking time out of her day to chat with us. This was great. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening, and we will try and do better next time. What song is this? What is that song?
I don't know. We'll figure it out later.
I think it's the intro of the song as well, if that helps.
Oh, I know that song. Shit. It's something classic rock because...
It sounds like the theme music from like a family-friendly 80s sitcom, like a Doogie Howser type show.
You're doing it wrong. Tim actually gets it right.
Ah, oh, why can't you just whistle into Shazam?
Okay, Tim, I'm going to kill you if you keep humming that, because I need to figure out what it is, and you're just making this worse.
Well, we'll release it in the B-roll of the show, and then someone will...
So, we have a few events coming up, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, we'd like to bring your attention to a cause we all care about. Tim can't figure out what this song is. We're going to hum it for you now. And if you could, you know, figure it out, call this 1-800 number. Make your pledge now.
Hopefully one of our three listeners will know.
We've all been there. It's true. We have a problem that we can all really identify. We can all get behind this. You know, everyone knows someone affected by song dystopia. Dystopia, not quite the word. What?
Disassociation?
Hanging in the window in the evening on a Friday night. Little light is shining through the window, lets me know everything's alright. Summer breeze.